Hello, folks. I'd like to welcome you to the premium edition of the Labor Relations Information Systems podcast. My name is Will Aitchison. I'm thrilled to welcome today Margie Brogan, one of the country's esteemed arbitrators, to talk to us about a list that I've put together that I colloquially entitle Six Questions Labor and Management Want to Ask Arbitrators. And if it has to have a subtitle, it will be Demystifying Some of the Things About Arbitration. Margie's a full-time labor arbitrator and mediator. She's had 28 years of experience. She rose to become the president of the very prestigious National Academy of Arbitrators. She's 1 year removed from that now, so she's in the past president role. She's heard hundreds of arbitration decisions, many of them involving public safety employees. She received her Doctor of Jurisprudence from Villanova University, and she's been on the adjunct faculty for the law schools at St. Joseph's University and on the West Coast, the School of Law at the University of California at Berkeley. I stumbled there, Margie, because I always want to call it Bolt Hall. Welcome, Marjorie, to the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Will. I am so thrilled to be on your podcast. I've been listening to it, and it's terrific. I've been recommending it to my arbitrator friends, so this is really an honor.
Has that been you who's been listening to the podcast?
I knew we
had one somewhere. So,
yes,
Margie. It's you. Margie, let's start off with a pretty basic question a lot of people have. How do you become an arbitrator? And if you could use your own experience to inform that, I think that would be very helpful.
Well, I love this question, Will, because it's close to my heart. I've been working probably my entire career helping people become arbitrators. And, you know, we desperately need it now, even though work is somewhat reduced, because we need younger folks and people, diversity as arbitrators. My experience was, you know, different 28 years ago because I was an attorney with the National Labor Relations Board, and I taught at night at St. Joe's. And, you know, my experience at the board, I met all these advocates. I was very young for an arbitrator, and there weren't many women, but Philadelphia was very welcoming to that, and I had, you know, people who helped me. I didn't have a mentor, per se, because, you know, I would say the more experienced arbitrators didn't think I was going to make it. But I ended up finding some folks who helped me out. And now, all these years later, when I was president of the Academy, I created an outreach initiative to help new folks around the country. And it's based out of the regions of the National Academy of Arbitrators, sort of connect people who want to try to be an arbitrator and who... and with someone who could mentor them. But let me say this first and foremost, it's not an easy thing to do, especially now. First, you got to be a neutral, which means that you don't represent either management or union. And that means that most people have to find some other way to eat, as we say. And yet you need a good decade of labor management experience in some manner. Education, labor representative, management representative, counsel for either side. It's always helpful if you jumped over to the other side of the table or sometimes represent both sides. I know that makes people like aghast that happens, but it does sometimes show your neutrality. It was easier for me because I was a neutral from the beginning in the board and I never represented either side. So, you know, that's how it's happening now. But we do need new people to start down this road.
Well, Margie, how does an arbitrator get her or his first case? How does that happen?
So, and this is, you know, Will, as you know, I have practices on both the East and West Coast, and it's very different in how it happens. So in the East Coast, particularly in the urban areas, the American Arbitration Association is the big player that assists parties in connecting with arbitrators. And they put us on lists, and then the lists go out, and people are selected from the list. And it's easier, somewhat, in the East Coast to get started because the AAA assists new arbitrators. In the West, it's more, and I say West, I'm talking about Northern California. That's my experience. It's more word of mouth, where, again, it's really helpful to go to labor management meetings, local meetings at the Academy. May I just do a shout out to the Northern California National Academy of Arbitrators, local folks. They are so welcoming and invite folks to their meetings and explain how a lot of this works. But there's much more permanent panels they call, which is such an oxymoron. It means that the parties, union, management, pick 5 to 10 arbitrators, and those folks do all their cases for the next year. But of course, you know, there are methods for getting rid of somebody on that panel, hence it's not very permanent, but it's helpful to the parties. So it's a little trickier when there is that sort of only permanent panel arrangement. Now, for public safety, much of that work comes from state panels. And, you know, there are ways to get on those panels. You apply for them, and then your name is listed. And that's the way it works in California. So we have the same kind of panels in the East Coast as well. So it's either from an appointing agency like the AAA, the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service, or any of these state panels. And, you know, experienced arbitrators can assist newer folks in applying to those panels.
I'm gonna put you on the spot, perhaps, a little bit with this next question. Do you have to be a lawyer to be an arbitrator? And if the answer is no, does it help?
The answer is probably yes now. It used to be no. And there are some magnificent arbitrators who are not lawyers. But unfortunately, and I say it for this profession, it's become more litigious. And I think it's helpful if you have a law degree. But it is not required. And it's certainly if you have some sort of educational background, that would suffice. But to come out and not to be a lawyer right now is a little harder to get started in arbitration. I'm working very hard right now with 8 new arbitrators on the East Coast. Half are lawyers, half are not. I think they're all going to be successful, but they also have a labor management background that is unique and, I think, you know, multi-layered. And so I think they're going to be successful. I'm hoping they are. But it does help if you have a law degree. It does help.
I think of the cases that I've handled in arbitration, and you know, at some point in your career, you simply stop counting how many you have done. Mm-hmm. But I've done a bunch. And it's my recollection is that virtually all of them involve legal issues of some degree of complexity or not. Mm-hmm. And then I realize when I say that is a self-selecting proposition, that because I'm a lawyer, I'm probably much more likely to raise legal issues than a non-lawyer would, and that perhaps the most troublesome matchup you might see in arbitration is where you've got a lawyer on one side and a non-lawyer on the other. What do you think about that?
Well, number one, I wouldn't say that necessarily the lawyer is going to do a better job than a non-lawyer in an arbitration setting. I think this is also cultural, Will, because in the East Coast and my growing up as an arbitrator, there are many, many non-lawyers doing cases, and there still are on the advocate's point of view, and they are masters at it. And they are masters at going right to the heart of what's important. I'm a lawyer. Everyone I know in my family is a lawyer, practically. So I can say this. Lawyers sometimes focus on issues that aren't important. And they do look to legal precedent. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't matter if the case deals with, you know, violence in the workplace or theft. Or, I mean, you know, the idea of legal precedent doesn't always make sense. Here, when I started arbitrating, my children were very small. And, you know, of course, you know, as a working mom, I felt guilty that I was out, you know, during the day. And so at dinner table, I would tell the story of my case. And of course, you know, I would try to make it as interesting as possible. But I was always struck by the idea that my kids, at a very young age, they got to the heart of what was right and what was wrong, what made sense, what was fair, what was just. And I try to do that as an arbitrator. So I would say that, you know, what's a harder question is when one advocate is more experienced than the other, not lawyer versus non-lawyer. And if you put in a lawyer who comes from a litigation background, doesn't know labor law, and they go in there and they think it's like, you know, a civil service hearing or something, you know, those are the hard ones for an arbitrator because they don't really know what they're doing. And I think a person steeped in labor law, even if they're coming at it from a non-lawyer point of view, has got the advantage.
And reflecting on that, one of the people in the public sector that I know who has been perhaps as successful as anybody else is a fellow by the name of John Crystal, who's a police supervisor. He works with the Police Supervisors Union in Newark, New Jersey. He's not a lawyer, and he has this incredible string of victories going up against lawyers. And it's pretty impressive to see. For what it's worth, I completely agree with you. I've handled cases against non-lawyers where I've been incredibly impressed with their ability to handle cases. And I've handled cases with lawyers where I've come away from that thinking, wow, did that just happen? It really does depend upon the individual, their experience, their intelligence, their kind of their intuition as to how a hearing should go.
Right. No, I totally agree. You know, it makes me cranky when when I get a lawyer who's just trying to be difficult and not putting on the case they that I really need to hear. Experience really does so much in that regard.
So let's get into some of our more substantive issues. And the first one deals with the rules of evidence in arbitration. As you've heard, Margie, from time to time, I'll talk about arbitrators in our seminars before you talk about arbitrators. And I have a line that may be a little bit too glib, but I'll give it to you anyway. I say, there are no rules of evidence in arbitration. At least none that I've ever been able to discern. Is that right?
No, I would say no. At least not when Will, you and I have known each other for decades, probably, or close to two, and you've never appeared before me. I make it really clear when a case begins that don't try to give me hearsay to prove up any kind of material claim or defense. People who pick me regularly know that. So if you've got an investigative packet that's filled with handwritten statements, type statements that were taken during the investigation, sure, that comes in to show the state of mind of the employer, the due process. But you better bring those people into me and let me hear them. If you want me to sustain the discipline, I'm speaking from the employer point of view, or if the grievant has a alibi witness or whatever, that person needs to come. A statement standing alone, which is hearsay, for those of folks who aren't lawyers, hearsay is really pretty simple. It's the person who said it isn't in the room, be it the person who wrote it in a document or the person who said it out loud, it's just not there. And don't you think your arbitration should be dependent upon good, reliable evidence? And it's not reliable to take just what's written on a statement because the union doesn't get a chance or the other side doesn't get a chance to cross-examine, there's a question of whether I can judge the demeanor, the perception, what's the person's memory now, all those things we can explore. So to me, it's really crucial that something has to come in for the truth. And so I need to hear that we call the declarant. But you're right. I let everything in, quote unquote. I admit it typically because that's what arbitration is that you allow all the documents to be present. I'm not a jury. I can discount things that I won't rely on. It'll go to the right side of my desk of the papers that these are the papers I'm not going to look at while I'm writing my award. But to make sure that everything that both sides wants to come in. I err on the side of letting in, but I make it really clear when they introduce it. I say, you can let it in, but you know, if you want me to sustain your point of view, I need to hear that person. And so you may not have arbitrators to do that. I would say that's the majority rule of the arbitrators I speak to in the National Academy of Arbitrators. And you know, the old take it for what it's worth really annoys me. I try not to say that.
But Margie, others do say it. I've heard that once or twice.
You know,
let me give you a brief war story where I'm telling a tale on myself. So I'm a young kid lawyer, and I'm doing a lumber workers case up in northern Idaho. And the question concerns the interpretation of the seniority clause in the collective bargaining agreement. And the other side, the employer, wants to put into evidence a collective bargaining agreement from a different company and a different union in a different state that has a different seniority clause order to establish how our seniority clause should be interpreted. And I objected, and the arbitrator said, I'll let it in for what it's worth.
Oh, no. That's terrible.
That's precisely the moment of time at which I realized I only have so many breaths left in my days on Earth. Wow. I'm not going to waste any of them objecting in arbitration.
Yeah.
And largely, I'll go through hearings. I will go through multi-day hearings. I can think of one fairly recently that was 13 days long where I didn't make one objection because I knew the arbitrator. And I knew the arbitrator knew the rules that that you're talking about as to what sort of credibility you give evidence when it comes in. And I knew I could rely on her to make that judgment. So I'm just simply not going to be sitting there saying objection, lack of foundation, or objection, hearsay, whatever it might be.
And I appreciate that when people know that. And that's key, Will, is that you know your arbitrator. And I know in your training seminars, you teach folks as to, you know, how you can learn more about your arbitrator, which is so key. And it's hard because you get these lists with names you don't know. But if you know your arbitrator, or you could have a conversation in the beginning of the arbitration, if you don't know them well, to find out what their stance is on that. I really appreciate when people don't interrupt my hearings with continuing objections. And certainly after I've ruled once and I've made it clear that, you know, I'm not taking any of this hearsay for the truth, and the other side keeps pointing it out to me, objecting again and again, you know, that's one of the things that irritates me because I just want the hearing to go forward. But there are personalities, and some of those personality arbitrators are dear friends of mine, that they will just stop the hearing and say, this stuff is not coming in. They're very adamant about that. And I would again say that certain parts of the country are more, there are more those folks there. And we have a lot of fun at our academy meetings. We get on a panel, we're like in front of, you know, we let our hair down when it's just academy folks. And we talk about how we all differ, which I know is frustrating to advocates that we're different. But I think it's key that your folks find out what this arbitrator is going to do. And if you don't know, I do think in the beginning you need to object. You need to point out this is hearsay and you know, see whether that person is going to take it for the truth or not.
You said something I think that's really important from the standpoint of an advocate, whether you're management or labor. As you indicate, I spend some time in our grievances and arbitration seminar talking about how you go about researching arbitrators. It's really hard to overstate the importance of doing that. Because arbitrators, like all of us, have predilections, we have track records, and when you're in the process of winnowing down a list of arbitrators from, say, 7 or 11 to the person who's going to decide a case that's very important to you, you'd be really foolish not to research all of the names on that list, read some of their prior opinions, talk to the advocates who presented cases before this individual before you decide whether or not you want to strike that person's name from a list. And it's just stunning to me that even very experienced lawyers sometimes don't go through that process because they just assume they know.
Yeah,
it's free information. Let's figure it out.
And what is arbitration, yeah. Will? Right, it's final and binding. Your ability to appeal my award is so limited, so you're stuck with, you know, a bad ruling oftentimes, and so why risk it? Why not start from the beginning and know who you have?
And Margie, let me kind of expand on this issue of evidence and talk about a particular type of evidence. I've observed that over time, arbitration hearings have gotten longer and they have gotten more, not so much more complex factually, but you hear from a lot more witnesses for a longer period of time. And a part of that development is that you almost routinely now we'll see expert witnesses in certain types of arbitration cases where 20, 30 years ago, you wouldn't see an expert witness in that sort of role. I'm thinking of a case I handled a few years ago where there actually were five expert witnesses talking about different things. I know. I'd like your take on whether expert witnesses who are really quite expensive to the parties, they can be $10,000, $20,000, even $30,000 or more, depending upon how much time that they spend on the case and their background, whether expert witnesses are really worth that money and the time you spend in a hearing on them. And if, in particular, there were any types of experts that you find really helpful or not all that helpful?
So I'm fascinated with what the five experts were first and foremost. Would you share with me what their areas were? I mean, I could see financials. Was it an interest arbitration?
No, this was a discharge case. It was a police officer use of deadly force case.
Okay.
So you had a human factors expert to talk about the officer's perception. Actually, you had two of human factor experts, one for each side. You had a tactics expert, one for each side, and a damages expert.
Mm-hmm. I think your area of the law, fortunately or unfortunately, is moving in that direction because of issues. I mean, I could see, here's what I could see from my perspective. I must say to you, well, I get experts in what we call employment arbitrations, that is non-union arbitrations, and that typically deals with the issue of damages, the issue of remedy, and financials. So I get those experts. I think, of course, you know, that's helpful. I also think that it's helpful to have someone who would deal with the issue that, you know, for instance, the body cam issue that you're such an expert on. I think that's a new technology. And the limitations or the good parts of that is something that I would appreciate an expert speaking to me. Perhaps at some point there could be an issue of maybe collection of drug samples. I've had that. I can't say I really needed that person because I've done piles. You know, I've done so much trucking in my life, UPS and otherwise. I've had so many drug cases, and I've heard about collection processes, but sometimes people feel the need, you know, to bring in an expert. All of that is okay. I don't know it's necessary in terms of, you know, you would know better than I would, Will. You're a much greater expert in this area. I would typically lean on the side of saying no to an expert. Expense, dueling experts. At the end of the day, when the two experts disagree on almost everything, what have you really left the arbitrator with? So, I go with that. I would say what really is unnecessary, and I'm starting to see this, are people that come in with their experts who go to the very issue at play for an arbitrator. Demeanor, truthfulness. It astounds me when they bring in somebody for this, because seriously, if there's anything that I've honed over this time are those things. That's what you're hiring me for. And maybe occasionally a handwriting expert, you know, if the issue is really, you know, did the grievant write that or not, I guess, you know, that would be okay. But oftentimes I think you can find folks within your organization that can educate me as to a process, as to procedure, in a manner that would be absolutely fine. And of course they can bring in their person from their organization in the same manner. And you're not dealing with the expense of experts. But I know you have to respond to the other side, so it's hard for you. But I can tell you when I see an expert coming in, I go, oh, brother, you know.
Well, and you're right. I mean, I actually wouldn't have had a problem in that deadly force case not using an expert had I thought to go to the other side in advance and said, hey, if we don't, you don't, can we agree on that? But I suspect they wouldn't have agreed. But
then you have
if one side has it, the other side kind of has to.
I totally agree. You know, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but Will, you know, the not talking to the other side is one of those things that always surprises me in arbitration, because there's so much that can be, at least not if worked out, at least you know in advance, if you have a relationship with the other side. And most people that appear before me are good folks. You know, they're not doing a game of gotcha. Some are, but most aren't. And, you know, if you don't talk to the other side about certain things, like, and little things too, like the court reporter, or, you know, hey, you subpoenaed these documents and I'm really not going to be able to bring them all to you on Monday, you know, to wait till the day of hearing is just, it never makes sense to me, and it causes so much trouble. So.
Let me go back to experts. By the way, I agree with you completely. I'm a real fan of exchanging exhibits days mm-hmm. before the hearing and mm-hmm. just work. I mean, why do we want to spend any of your time and the court reporter's time and money from our standpoint having you deal with that sort of issue?
Right.
But let me go back to experts for just a moment. Where are you on the polygraph issue? And are your views, do you think, representative of the majority of arbitrators?
I would say that I have never ruled that polygraph evidence is admissible yet. I haven't been asked, though, I would say, in about 4 years. And, you know, I'm seeing some literature on this topic. You know, I don't typically change my mind, but sometimes, you know, I mean, this is something that is technological and can be improved. So I would certainly be interested in hearing the arguments, and certainly you'd need the expert there on that. I mean, you just can't put in a report. That has happened to me, on numerous occasions where they just try to put the report in, and I don't think that's sufficient, frankly. So, but I would say as of now, it is not something that has helped me in deciding whether or not the grievant is telling me the truth.
It's an interesting issue from a litigation tactics standpoint. I have on a couple of occasions. First of all, let me tell you personally, I'm not too much of a believer in polygraphs. The Senate Select Committee that actually looked into the reliability of polygraphs a number of years ago found that on the average, they correctly determine truthfulness 62% of the time, which is a little better than a coin flip, but you know,
not much more.
not that much better than a coin flip that I'd like to like test anything significant on it. But there have been a couple of times when I've wanted to put in polygraph evidence, and so you call the polygrapher to the witness stand. Typically, the other side will object, and this has happened both ways, by the way. I've seen employers do exactly the same thing. The other side will object, and then the person who's calling the polygrapher will say, I'd like to lay a foundation as to the scientific reliability of the polygraph, and then the arbitrator's pretty much stuck, right? They have to listen to that, and then the arbitrator... I've never had polygraph evidence actually admitted by an arbitrator. But by the time you're all through laying the foundation, the arbitrator knows that you've had a polygraph examination done of, in my case, the grievant, and that I want that polygraph evidence into the record.
And of course, so why would you want it but for what the report showed?
It is really an odd issue of litigation dynamics.
It's definitely the bell has rung, yes, as they say.
That's true. Okay, moving on through our list of issues, I want to talk about something that has kind of fascinated me for a long time, and that's the burden of proof in disciplinary cases. You commonly see arbitrators refer to three of them, and the first is proof by a preponderance of the evidence, which is 50% plus one of the evidence, and then the other is proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the standard that we're comfortable with in criminal cases, and sometimes people describe as 90 or 95% of the evidence. I'm not sure you can put a number on that one. And then the burden of proof that's in the middle somewhere, which is clear and convincing evidence. And my observation has been that in disciplinary cases, if the sanction is less than the most serious of sanctions, termination or demotion, if it's something like a five-day suspension or a written reprimand, the vast majority of arbitrators will be using a preponderance of the evidence standard. My observation is also that if it is a very serious type of disciplinary sanction, demotion or termination, a slight majority of arbitrators will be using the clear and convincing evidence test, and that if it is a serious disciplinary sanction, and if the actions, if proven, would violate the criminal laws of the state wherever this thing happened, that a very small minority of arbitrators will use a proof beyond a reasonable doubt standard. And when I look at the cases and look at the facts and how the arbitrator ends up analyzing the facts after they've gone through that selection process of the burden of proof, I'm left shrugging my shoulders saying, does it really matter? Or are arbitrators just simply saying to themselves, you know what, this is what I think happened, and then writing their ruling based on that? What's your take on all that?
Well, I guess I turn on you and say, do you know what the difference between clear and convincing and a preponderance is? I mean, isn't it a question of what's sort of in your gut as you're deciding a case? I've never sat on a jury. I would imagine, you know, I mean, there are jury instructions for what it means. But to me, first and foremost, to answer your question, I have never articulated a quantum of proof in one of my awards. I've been asked, and I typically, and then I, you know, I fudge it typically. I drop a footnote and say, you know, parties have argued over the, you know, the burden here. And I say, whatever burden I employ, this is what I find, which sort of goes to what you think is what arbitrators do. What I find really persuasive to me are arguments, putting aside the burdens of, look at what this person's been accused of. Look at what this will mean for this person going forward. Lack of truthfulness. You know what the issues are with regard to a police officer testifying in the future. Theft, if it's a discharge that follows that person for the rest of their lives. Those arguments to me, I find really, really, you know, take it home, because you're not just arguing legal semantics of the quantum. You're talking about the facts before the arbitrator. You're trying to convince that arbitrator, and you often do, that this is a really serious accusation that will haunt this individual. So, Ms. Arbitrator, you better get it right. And I find that more powerful than arguing to me which burden should be employed.
Okay. And I really do think in their hearts, like the majority of arbitrators, do exactly the same thing that you're talking about. I think arbitrators are fundamentally tired of the same cut and paste page and a half in briefs on what the burden of proof should be.
Yeah, I agree with that one. I only see newer arbitrators like typically talk about clear and convincing. I don't see the more experienced people do that. But then you review far more arbitration awards than I do.
And now that I mentioned briefs, this is another development I've seen over time in arbitration. You used to see arbitrations close pretty routinely with an oral closing argument, like you'd see in court in a criminal case or a civil case. And then over time, perhaps as advocates have more and more often been lawyers, we've seen one side or the other want to write a closing argument, a brief, in lieu of an oral argument. And then over time, we've seen those briefs expand so that instead of perhaps a 5-page brief or a 10-page brief, I mean, a 5-page brief today would be a lusus naturae, right? It'd be a freak of nature. Who writes a 5-page brief? I for one, can't say my name in 5 pages. It's pretty tough. It's kind of like the arms race. If one side wants to write a brief, the other side is saying, okay, now I'm stuck. Now I got to write a brief. And we're costing our clients an awful lot of money by writing these briefs, where we could just simply wrap up the case with a 20-minute or so closing argument. What are your predilections? Do you want to see a brief, or is there a particular type of case in which you'd like to see a brief, and others in which you think an oral closing argument would suffice?
I think this is an excellent question, and I appreciate the opportunity to give my view on it. Certainly, in your 13-day case, you would want to give the arbitrator a brief, right? Just to be able to pull that case together. You want to make sure that you're pulling it together in the way, or that she's pulling it together the way that you want her to. And so I would say on most multi-day cases, a brief is helpful to the arbitrator. In my world, there are a lot of cases that don't have reporters, most particularly in the Philadelphia area. It's more the norm not to have a reporter than to have one. If we have a long day of hearing without a reporter, I'm pretty tired from taking notes. And then if you're going to now do a closing, which you say 20 minutes, like that's like saying a 5-page brief. You know, I don't remember any closing to me that's 20 minutes. So I sometimes have closings that go on for a long time. And that's because it's a matter of contract. That's what the parties agreed. That's the process. So I would say if it's a multi-day case, if legal issues are presented, if there's no reporter and it's been a very long day or a multi-day case, those are the times when, you know, I'd really appreciate a brief. I also appreciate being asked whether I want a brief or not. That's helpful to the arbitrator. But I don't think they're necessary in a case where there are not legal issues presented of any importance. You know, it's an issue of whether or not a person stole time, an issue of whether or not they engaged in some kind of verbal altercation, physical altercation. I mean, you know, tell the story. And I think that's really helpful to both sides to do that, because their clients want to hear, they want to see you work. And I've been told that by clients. I've been told that by counsel. They really, their clients appreciate to hear it. Now, of course, the grievant, you know, has to be prepared for it. So it's a good idea to tell your grievant, well, I'm going to ask for oral closings, but then you're going to have to listen to the other side say not nice things about you. Can you handle that? Because sometimes, you know, some individuals would prefer you put that in writing. So I think those are all the things involved. I love when I have a hearing where there's like, and I love reporters, but like a down and dirty case where we're done in a day and they orally close it and they hand it to me, my mind is so fresh with those facts. And whether there's a reporter or not, I love those cases, because then I can really like just issue the award. So it's not even just an expense issue. It's a question of timing. And I do believe that's what arbitration used to be, labor arbitration, and it's evolved. But here's a third alternative, and you probably do this, Will, sometimes. If you have a reporter, you can do what I often do is encourage the side that wants to do the oral closing to do the oral closing to the reporter. And the way I do it is everybody leaves the room except the reporter, counsel, and their side argues it right to the reporter as if they were arguing it to me. They put that in a separate transcript from the rest. I get that from the reporter, I, the arbitrator, and then the other side writes a brief. And then when I get both sides, I cross-serve them, and then everybody's happy. And it works really well, I think. It's not that, now not everyone's comfortable with that approach, because of course the other side has had an opportunity to read the transcript, cite the transcript pages to me, which, you know, can be helpful. And the other side is doing an oral closing without that advantage. But it is an alternative to either or.
I've got to tell you, Margie, you'd never convince me on that. Because when I do an oral closing, I'm watching you. And I'm not just watching you. This is a litigant's confession here. I'm not just watching you. I'm watching as much as I can the court reporter and everybody else in the room, because there's a feedback loop that goes on there. Yeah. And the notion of my giving an oral closing without the arbitrator present in the room, I'd sort of say, why would I do that?
Well, you know, sometimes that we're not listening to you and that we're really typing our grocery list for the following week. You do know that.
I am totally convinced of that. Let me confess to you a dirty secret, and not so much a secret because it's public. And I'm glad that we're talking on the phone so you can't hit me after I tell you this. I once gave a 12-hour closing argument in an arbitration, 11 hours with lunch. We took an hour for lunch.
Wow.
I know. And I used a PowerPoint presentation to do it, and I had 811 slides in the PowerPoint presentation.
That's like being stuck in somebody's basement when they're showing you the slides of their vacation.
Yeah, I know. I know. And it was a winner-take-all case where the arbitrator had to award. It was last best offer, total package arbitration. the arbitrator had to award either our total package or the employer's total package, and the difference was $45 million between the two packages. So it was just like, it was an amazing sort of thing.
Right. Well, and for your audience, but, you know, the difference between an interest arbitration where you're creating the collective bargaining agreement and a grievance arbitration where you're dealing with an interpretation of the contract or discipline are very different animals. So I can see multi-day hearings and need for briefs, you know, oral closings that are complex like that. But in a grievance arbitration, not as much, in my view.
I would agree with you. Last thing, I asked Margie to come up with a list of five things that irritate her as an arbitrator. And the reason I did that is not so much to put her on the spot as to put all of us on the spot as to whether or not we engage in any of these activities in arbitration. I think it's an incredible learning experience to hear from an experienced arbitrator what it is we as litigants are doing wrong in these arbitration cases. And Margie, over the course of this interview, you've mentioned a couple of things. Mm-hmm. One is not talking to the other side mm-hmm. in advance of the hearing mm-hmm. to either try to agree on evidence or perhaps try to reach a settlement. And the second was repetitively objecting to the same thing throughout the hearing. I wonder what fills out your list here of your top five.
Great. Well, I think probably the top one is when the representatives or counsel misstate the evidence, and this would typically happen in a brief. That makes me crazy because number one, it's terribly misleading and I think unethical. But secondly, you know, they're thinking I'm just not going to pay attention. And in a typical briefing system in labor arbitration, there isn't a chance for a reply brief. So now I have had that when it's been badly misstated. But I'll give you an example of a recent case I had. Going to the way I view evidence and the way I rule, I heard the case of the employer, and I do this sometimes. I wait till it's completely over. They had brought none of the important witnesses to prove up their case. And I said in the hallway, I'm not taking any of that for the truth. And I think, frankly, you should put the person back to work. Arbitrators do that sometimes. The parties talk for like an hour. They decide not to do that. And the union finished their case and the employer said, wanted to file a brief. Well, the employer's brief was filled with the evidence that I had thrown out, that I had said, I throw it out so much as saying, I'm not relying on this. I'm not taking this for the truth, but wrote it like I had, like somehow I was going to be convinced that since the evidence was so damning that I would find it to be true. And I must say that annoyed me and it doesn't make any sense. So be very careful when you're writing your brief, when you're doing your oral closing, to state the evidence to the best of your ability that is correct.
What I try to counsel younger lawyers on this issue, Margie, is that mm-hmm. All of us as lawyers, particularly in a labor relations setting, whether we're management or labor, we have almost a finite amount of credibility. And if you lose it, if you lose a piece of your credibility doing something like misstating the facts, you're not going to get that back, or mm-hmm. you're not going to get that back for years and years and maybe mm-hmm. never. And that should be one of our most precious resources when we're doing an arbitration or anything, negotiations, whatever it is we're doing. I couldn't agree with you more.
Right.
Okay. Next up.
Well, a big one, and this is something that's tough for a new arbitrator, is disrespectful conduct by an advocate. An advocate that wants to put on a show, yells at the other side, yells at the arbitrator, bullies the witnesses. Starting out, I saw a lot of that. I would complain privately in the hallway, and counsel would say, my client wants to see the show. And frankly, it does not persuade me in any respect. And, you know, what's the adage, you know, when you have the facts, argue the facts. When you don't have the facts, argue the law. When you don't have the law, argue the facts. And when you don't have either, pound on the table. Well, what that communicates to me is you don't have a case if you're yelling. And it's always difficult for a newer arbitrator to deal with that because we don't have any contempt powers and it's just us. So, and a very experienced arbitrator that I know, Will, you know, George Nicolau, who's still very active and doing a terrific job. He created this thing he called the escalation of pain, which he wrote long ago in an academy proceeding, and I follow, which is I start slow, and I'm giving this advice, and perhaps if there's any would-be arbitrators out there. But basically, it's start out with just saying, move on at the table, if that doesn't work, taking the parties outside and saying, you know, this isn't working for me, and you're being disrespectful, and not helping your case, and let's go back inside. And if it still doesn't work, then you'd say at the table in front of the client. So if an arbitrator says that to you, I say to the advocates that this isn't working and move on and it's hurting your case, listen, because there isn't anybody else making the decision but that individual. And always, I don't want to, now it makes me laugh. Why would you want to piss off the arbitrator? But some people do that. And I have literally maybe 3 times in my life walked out of a hearing room, said, you know what, we're going to do this another day. And, you know, this side's going to pay the bill. And I have done that.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't recommend that to new arbitrators, but this is the number one question I get from new arbitrators. Help me with this. What do I do? That tells me that there's a lot of misbehaving people out there. And I got to say that, you know, that the fire and brimstone that may work in a courtroom isn't meant for the arbitration room. And, you know, gentility, respect, listening, it's far more persuasive. It's far more helpful to the process.
Is this a geographic thing, Margie? Because I have not seen lawyers yelling in arbitration hearings. Is this more of an East Coast thing?
I don't want to pinpoint that it might be, but, you know, and my friends in Northern California say the same. And I must say, I don't think I've seen that. I've seen it occasionally in the West. I do think you see it more in the urban areas on the East Coast. But I do think what's starting to happen now, Will, is you're getting lawyers coming in. They're not from a labor management background. They don't understand that you have to go back to that lawyer across the table to bargain a contract, to bargain a deal. And it doesn't do you any good to walk into an arbitration room and misbehave like that. So they're coming in for the one case from a big firm. And so I would say, completely, it's still occurring, and perhaps there's a little more on the East Coast, but I think I've seen it everywhere.
Let me tell you how close I ever got to that, Margie. I'm telling another story on myself here. So this is an interest arbitration hearing, and the employer is called an economist as an expert witness. Now, I think most trial lawyers would tell you that the expert witness they most like to cross-examine is an economist because it's not quite the science that it is made out to be, and there's a lot of fodder frequently on cross-examination. Well, this guy constructed his own consumer price index borrowing from a nearby local CPI, and then adjusting the weights of the various components of the CPI according to what the local chamber of commerce said weights should be. I mean, it was just, it was totally a mess, right, as to what he was doing. It had no statistical significance at all. So I started cross-examining him, and after maybe a half hour or something like that, and I don't yell, I don't pound the table, but I can be somewhat relentless in cross-examination. After about a half hour, the arbitrator, Howell Langford, who I think you probably know.
I know him well, yes.
Howell interjected in the middle of the hearing when I paused probably to take a deep breath because I was panting, whatever it was. And Howell said, "Mr. Aitchison, I want to tell you, if you are making an omelet, the eggs are broken, they have been stirred, and they are set." And, of course, I said the only thing that a lawyer can possibly say in those circumstances, which is, thank you, no further questions.
Exactly.
Howell is lovely like that.
Howell is great. I'll be talking to him tomorrow, as a matter of fact. I'll tell him you used that. yeah. I mean, I definitely say, you know, the horse is long dead. You know, you beat it so much. But at least you listened. I can tell you that times that counsel are so intent on the way they want to present a case that they just are not convinced that I've heard enough. So they just keep going, and they'll look at me with these eyes pleading, like, I really think I need to ask these questions. And I do think it's key to, if it's an arbitrator you trust, to listen to that arbitrator. Have really one more thing to talk about, which is really is something that really bothers me, is people coming to arbitration unprepared. And I know that there's reasons for that. You couldn't get in touch with your witnesses to the last second, and there might be some travel snafus, whatever they are. But there are some advocates that on a regular basis come to an arbitration hearing, and they're just simply not prepared. They wait till the day of to talk to witnesses. They realize that there's missing witnesses. They don't exchange documents, and/or they don't even bring more than one copy of a document. So we're wasting our time while they go get copies of it. And then through cross-examination or very bad direct examination, they're just trying to explore things because they haven't really focused on their case. They haven't created the theory of the case. And it's like a case in search of a theory. So I would say I see that a lot. I see that with newer folks. But I just see some people have bad work habits and arbitration. You know, I am in such awe of advocates who come before me, and all they have to do in a day, they have to prepare a case, they have to cross-examine, they have to direct, they have to take notes, especially if they're going to do an oral closing at the end. Daunting, especially if you have no one with you. I get how hard it is to put these cases on, but at the same time, you know, I don't have a lot of patience for a lack of preparation. And I think this is something, we arbitrators, we talk about this. I can tell you this is something that really annoys us as a whole. Yeah, so
I couldn't agree more. And my suggestion to other lawyers is, look, when you're preparing, you should spend just about as much time preparing the other side's case as you should yours, anticipating what the other side is going to do, preparing your cross-examination and your rebuttal, because it's all, you know, relatively predictable. We have information as to what's going on. When I see people show up unprepared in a hearing, and they're always on the other side in my case, I'm fully prepared to take advantage of that, and I will take advantage of that.
Of course.
But mentally, I'm shaking my head saying, this just can't happen. This isn't right. Well, on that cheery note, Marty, I want to thank you for spending this hour with us. I think it's been really informative, and And you've been very gracious giving us this time while you are vacationing. I won't say where, but vacationing in a wonderful location. And I look forward to talking to you again in the future about these sorts of issues.
Thank you, Will. Honor for me, a delightful hour. Thanks so much.
Okay, thanks.
Bye.
Bye. Folks, that's been Margie Brogan, as I've mentioned to you, the past president of the National Academy of Arbitrators. She is, by the way, a wonderful speaker in our seminars. She's spoken for us for many, many years, almost two decades now, talking about how an arbitrator evaluates specific cases. We'll next be doing that seminar in September in Las Vegas. Thanks for joining us. And with that, this is Will Aitchison signing off.